Yeah, so I'm going to tell you about supersymmetric quantum mechanics. So this is first of all, quantum mechanics is quantum field theory in one dimension. So it's a very simple example, or perhaps a first class of quantum field theories to study. And also, they're supersymmetric quantum field theories, so they have some additional structure that we're going to study. So this is a very, by now, it's a very well-developed topic. It was introduced by Witten in the context of studying Morse theory. So I think really from its outset, it was closely connected with geometry and topology. And so it's a topic that where the veil between the worlds of quantum field theory and mathematics is perhaps most thin. And so I think it's a good topic for this workshop. So before I start, let me just mention that there are two accounts of this topic that are already in the literature that are, I think, aimed at mathematicians. So I'm going to try to take a slightly different point of view, tell you about some of the things that are not contained here. But these are great. They contain lots of examples. And so if you want to take a look or dive deeper into the topic, then these are some references you might want to check out. So before I start, maybe I should also say that I'm a physicist, so I apologize for any imprecisions in what I say. If you feel like pointing them out, please go ahead. Or if you feel like helping me out when somebody does point them out, that would also be appreciated. Okay, so let me begin with some motivation. So first of all, we're going to be studying quantum field theory in one dimension. So let me say that supersymmetric quantum mechanics, SQM, is basically what I mean by supersymmetric quantum field theory in one dimension. So perhaps in the notation of this morning, my space-time manifold, if you like, M, is just going to be something like the real line. And so I might introduce a coordinate that I call time or Euclidean time on that line. And so we're just going to be working in one dimension. And for me, one of the most useful things about this is not just to study quantum mechanical systems by themselves as interesting examples of quantum field theory, but also because they're actually useful for studying quantum field theories in higher dimensions. So many, there are examples of many types of computations that you can do in higher dimensional field theories that can be reduced to those in quantum mechanics. And so typically the way that works is that you might imagine having, say, a d-dimensional quantum field theory, and you would like to study it on the product of, say, a line and some other compact space. Say MD minus one. And in many cases, computations in quantum field theories on spaces of this type can be boiled down to a computation in a quantum mechanics on the line. Now, this is in some sense a trivial statement because you can always take a quantum field theory on a space like this and regard it as a quantum mechanics with some infinite number of fluctuations of all of the fields on this internal space. But in many cases, and in particular in examples with supersymmetry, there are lots of examples of computations in this geometry that can be exactly captured by some nice finite dimensional quantum mechanics. So let me just give you one example of that to get going, which is something that perhaps will be discussed in later lectures. So the example I want to give you is in two dimensions. Uh, And something we know in two dimensions is that if you study boundary conditions, in let's say a two-dimensional supersymmetric quantum field theory, they form a category. And the general idea behind that is that you study boundary conditions. So here's my boundary of my two-dimensional space. And if you have two boundary conditions, say B1 and B2, then you can have local operators that live at the intersection between those two boundary conditions. And so these are what you might call a HOM from B1 to B2 in your category, are local operators that sit at this intersection. Now, this kind of configuration can be related by a state operator map to another configuration. Where you study the theory on an interval now with a boundary condition on either side. So where you say have B2 on the right and B1 on the left. And the idea here is you have to imagine that what I've done is I've taken this boundary here and I've brought it around the other side. And maybe that action of bringing it around the other side make some transformation on that boundary condition. I won't worry too much about what that is. And then instead of studying the local operators that live at the intersection between the boundary conditions, you're studying states of the system in this background.
Matt, confirm, the bulk of your theory is in the unshaded region?
That is correct, yes. Thank you. The bulk of my theory is in the unshaded region, yes. Absolutely. Okay, so if this is a topological theory, then the computations that I'm doing perhaps shouldn't depend on the distances between the boundary conditions. So I could imagine taking my interval and shrinking it. Like this. And once I've done that, then the system that I have looks exactly like a one-dimensional QFT or a quantum mechanics. And if the theory I begin in life out with is a 2D supersymmetric field theory, then what I will end up with here is a supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And so in this case, you can relate this space of HOMs here in your category of boundary conditions to the calculation of certain class of states in a quantum mechanics. And this type of viewpoint can be very useful, actually, for performing computations. So this is one example of why supersymmetric quantum mechanics can be useful. But it can also be useful in a variety of other setups in higher dimensions, which take this kind of form. Okay. So that's my motivation. So I'd now like to move on to tell you what quantum mechanics is. And so here comes the part of the talk where I should apologize if this material is extremely familiar to you, but at the very least, hopefully, it will allow me to just set up some notation. So 1.2 is quantum mechanics. Okay, so I'm a physicist, so according to the classification this morning, I'm allowed to talk about both states and operators, so I'm going to do that. So first of all, let me tell you what the states are. So you, when I say state, maybe I should just clarify. Think about this as the state of the system at some fixed time. And the states in quantum mechanics are elements, or really rays, in a complex Hilbert space. And I'm going to call that Hilbert space here omega. So in particular, because it's a Hilbert space, it has an inner product that I'll denote in the following way. And I should think about this as the space of states of my system. They can be really elements, or elements up to multiplication by a non-vanishing complex number. Okay, so in addition to states, I have what I'll call operators. Not quite observables yet, but so operators will be linear operators. So I'll denote them typically by A, and so they're linear operators from states to states. And they will generate an associative algebra. That I'll call curly A. Okay, so we have states and operators. And putting states and operators together, they tell us how to perform measurements of the system and what the outcomes of measurements might be. So first of all, I should tell you what the things that I can measure are. So things that I can measure or observables, so it might be things like the position or the momentum of a particle or the spin of a particle. These are described by self-adjoint operators. So for me, in particular, observables, or maybe I'll just say measurable quantities, will be self-adjoint operators. And in particular, a basic point about quantum mechanics is that if I have a certain operator which corresponds to some observable, like position or momentum or spin or energy, then the possible outcomes of a measurement of that quantity are given by the eigenvalues of this operator, or in other words, the spectrum of the operator. So if I have a self-adjoint operator A, the possible outcomes of a measurement of A are given by the spectrum of eigenvalues of A. And this is one of the reasons why we consider self-adjoint operators, is that the eigenvalues of a self-adjoint operator are real, and things we measure in physics should be real quantities, usually, real numbers. Okay. So finally, my final piece of data for my quantum mechanics is how things evolve in time. So this is what I've said so far is about describing the state of play at some fixed point in time. And then we should ask things how things evolve. So perhaps I should be a physicist and talk about Lorentzian signature, but just to be definite, today I'm going to talk about Euclidean signature. So I'll work with Euclidean time t. This was my coordinate on the line. And time evolution is governed by a distinguished self-adjoint operator called the Hamiltonian. Okay, so H is the Hamiltonian of the system. It's the operator that corresponds to measurements of energy. And it governs how things evolve in time. And there are two perspectives one can take in quantum mechanics. You can either think about the states evolving in time, that's sometimes called the Schrödinger picture, or you can think about the operators evolving in time, sometimes called the Heisenberg picture. And perhaps given we're going to be thinking about quantum field theories in higher dimensions, it may be that the Heisenberg picture is better for our purposes, but let me just write them both. So the Schrödinger picture is that states evolve. And how do they evolve? Well, in my Euclidean notation, they evolve according to the following equation. So the time derivative of a state is given by minus the Hamiltonian operator acting on a state. On the other hand, in the Heisenberg picture, it's the operators that evolve. And they depend on time in the following way. The time derivative of some the time derivative of some self-adjoint operator A is found by taking the commutator of that operator with the Hamiltonian, like this. And so perhaps one more definition, or while we're here, is that we have the notion that an operator can be conserved, or that it's a conserved charge. That would mean in the Heisenberg picture that the operator doesn't depend on time, which means that it commutes with the Hamiltonian. So let's say that an operator A is conserved if it commutes with the Hamiltonian. Okay, so these are basically the structures that I'm going to take to be the definition of a quantum mechanics. So in my lectures, I'm not going to discuss classical theories first and then quantize them. For me, quantum mechanics is fundamental, so I'm just going to go ahead and, yes. No particular reason. Okay, except that I thought that perhaps later in the workshop, we're going to be discussing Euclidean field theory mostly. Okay. It won't, just to reassure, that won't play any role going forward. Okay. So what I'm going to do is just tell you how to construct quantum mechanical systems out of some geometric data. Okay, so let me give you first an example, which is a very simple one. So this is a particle moving on a circle. So in this case, we take the Hilbert space of states to be L squared functions on the circle, complex functions. And there's a natural, with respect to a natural inner product, which is just given by integrating over the circle. Okay. Let me write it very explicitly, like this. So this is my Hilbert space of states. Let me give you an example of an operator. So an example of a self-adjoint operator is the momentum operator. Which we call P, which is given by minus I times the derivative with respect to the coordinate on the circle. What's the spectrum of this operator? Well, it's just the integers. In particular, I could also write down some nice basis of eigenfunctions. And I would write down something like this. N is an integer. Okay, so that's an example of a self-adjoint operator that corresponds to momentum. Just to mention a few more small things, the Hamiltonian, which governs how the system evolves in time, in this case is just given by p squared divided by 2, or minus half times the second derivative with respect to theta. And so the spectrum of the Hamiltonian, while it has the same, it's just proportional to p squared, so it will have the same eigenfunctions as p. And the eigenvalues are just given by n squared over 2, where n is an integer. And also, just a link with my definition here, purely because h is proportional to p squared, and anything commutes with itself, then momentum is conserved. Okay. So this is a basic example of a quantum mechanics. And I'm going to follow a similar structure now, given some geometric data. Given some geometric data, I'm just going to try to write down a quantum mechanics for you. So this is another example. And so let me just call this example is called the Riemannian sigma model. And so what I'm going to choose as my input, as my data, is a compact, smooth Riemannian manifold. And if I were doing a path integral or a Lagrangian point of view on quantum mechanics, or if I was doing the kind of thing that we were discussing in the first talk, you would regard the theory as a theory of maps from R into this target space. So here's X, and here's my map. So I would try to write down some action functional based on maps of this form. That's not what I'm going to do. I'm just going to write down exactly the structures that I've given you. So in particular, there's a Hilbert space, omega. And just like in the circle, what we're going to do is to take the Hilbert space to be complex functions on the target that are square normalizable. And again, there's a natural inner product that I get by integrating if x. Okay, so this is the Hilbert space. What do the operators look like? If I can find my board rubber. So just like in the case of a circle, here we have the momentum operator, which was something like a differential operator on the circle. Likewise, in my sigma model, operators are going to be essentially differential operators on X. And again, instead of trying to be rigorous about that, I'm just going to give you some examples. So my algebra of operators A is going to be differential operators on X. So let me give you a couple of nice examples that I can build. Well, the first thing I can do is if I have a smooth function, then I can define an operator which just multiplies the state by that function. So I have an operator A depending on F. And what that does is it takes a state and it just multiplies it by the function. Okay, so this is a particularly nice class of operators. So they form a commutative subalgebra. Inside my algebra of operators. In particular, if I choose the function to be a real function, then this will be a self-adjoint operator. And the second class of operators we have are related to vector fields. These are my differential operators on X. Or rather, let me say, given a vector field V, then I can define an operator, let's say A of V, which takes some state and gives back minus I times the action of the vector field. Whoops, on the function. So if I was writing this out in coordinates, in local coordinates, I would write something like this. And again, this kind of operator, if the vector field is real, then this will be a self-adjoint operator. Okay, these are what the operators look like. The Hamiltonian H we can take to be the Laplacian on X. And so in particular, if I write down Schrödinger's equation, for example, if I imagine that states are evolving with respect to time in the Schrödinger picture, then the time derivative of a state is given by minus the Laplacian acting on the state. And well, just to point out that this is the heat equation on x. Okay, finally, let me talk about conserved quantities in this model. So just like before in a circle, we had that momentum was conserved. Likewise, in a sigma model, if I take V to be a real vector field, and in particular, we demand that real vector field generate an isometry. X, then in this case, it's going to commute with V, with the Laplacian. And so in particular, this operator will be conserved. And this will be what we call a momentum, conserved momentum. Okay, so of course the first example I gave of a particle on a circle is just a special case of this when x is S1. Okay, so that's all I have to say about quantum mechanics. So are there any questions about that? Or if not, I'll now move on to talk about supersymmetry and how additional structures that we have from there. Okay. Okay, so section 1.3 is supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And a supersymmetric quantum mechanics is just a quantum mechanics, but it has some extra additional structures that we're going to write down. So, first of all, the Hilbert space should be Z2 graded. It should be a super vector space, or a super Hilbert space. So in particular, I can write my Hilbert space as a sum of even and odd parts, and states have a notion of being even or odd. And second, there should exist a pair of odd operators so I call them Q and its adjoint Q dagger. And they should obey the following algebra. So in particular, Q should square to 0. Q, the anticommutator of Q with Q dagger, should give back the Hamiltonian of my quantum mechanics. And also that Q dagger should square to 0. So this is the additional structure that I'm going to demand, at the very least, to have a supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Let me just point out an immediate consequence of the algebra that I've written down. So a consequence is that, in particular, Q and Q dagger commute with the Hamiltonian. So what this means is that Q and Q dagger are conserved. And sometimes, well, in the physics literature, we refer to these operators, Q and Q dagger, as superchargers. They're conserved charges that are odd. Maybe I should say that this definition of quantum mechanics is perhaps both under and over restrictive. There are many examples of supersymmetric quantum mechanics which involve perhaps one less, or actually even more superchargers of this type. This particular class of quantum mechanics is sometimes called n equals to 2. And this is what I'm going to focus on in the lectures. Question? Yeah. Yeah. Right, so Q and Q dagger are arbitrary, but they're adjoint to each other. Yes. Absolute question. Yeah. Let me be very clear. So ideally, I would like to define a single bracket which depends on the Z2 charge of the operator that I'm considering. But it's traditional in physics to denote a square bracket as a commutator and an angle bracket as an anticommutator. So at least for today, let me follow that convention. And then perhaps in the subsequent lectures, I'll...
In Phil's talk, those would have been square brackets.
Yes, I think that's right.
Not using plus.
Yes, let me make a definition and then... So this is not ideal, but let me just define for today. Whatever the operators are, angle brackets means this, and curly brackets means this. Okay. Okay, so this algebra has some symmetries. Which play an important role. Or more precisely, the algebra has some outer automorphisms, which, if realized in the physical theory, have important implications. So let me describe that next. So the algebra has some outer automorphisms. In particular, given by the group O2, which I'll write as U1 times Z2. And so let me just tell you what these do and how they transform all of the objects that we have. So the U1 is sometimes called the fermion number, or also the R charge. And this is something that transforms the operators that I have, so Q, Q dagger, and H, with the following weights. So it transforms with Q with plus one, weight plus 1, Q dagger with weight minus 1, and the Hamiltonian with weight 0. And that's something that leaves the algebra invariant. And the Z2 that I have, I'm going to call it charge conjugation. And this is something that simply interchanges Q and Q dagger while leaving the Hamiltonian H invariant. Now, these are just the automorphisms of the algebra. That doesn't necessarily mean that in any given theory they will be realized or they'll be symmetries of the theory. So what do I mean by that? Well, let me just say that this will be a symmetry if it lifts to an action on the Hilbert space. Yeah, so yes. So the question is, so here I said that this symmetry should lift to an action on the Hilbert space. And the question is also about operators, whether it acts on the operators. And the answer is yes, it should. Okay, although I'm not going to describe that explicitly, but I think I'll do that in the next lecture. Okay. For now, I'm just going to say describe its action on the Hilbert space. So let me look at the two cases in turn. So we have the fermion number and the charge conjugation. So for the fermion number, we have the following structure. There should be a self-adjoint operator that I'll call F. And that operator should generate the action. So in particular, and this partially answers your question, although not completely, F should act, should have the following properties. If I take its commutator with Q, that should give me Q. If I take its commutator with Q dagger, that should give me minus Q dagger. And if I take the commutator with H, that should give me zero. So in particular, again, it's a conserved charge, and it generates the action on Q and Q dagger in this way. And so generally, you would define the charge of an operator by a similar definition. So in particular, what are the consequences of this? Well, the first consequence is that the Hilbert space is promoted to a Z-graded Hilbert space, not just C2. So in particular, what do I mean? Well, I can write it as a direct sum of pieces where each piece contains states that have exactly charge J under the action of this operator. Okay, so in particular, let me mention that the original Z2 grading is recovered by taking minus 1 to this operator. So in particular, what I called omega even before is what I find by just taking this sum over the even parts. And likewise for the odd parts. Okay. So let me just draw a picture of the Hilbert space just to give you an idea schematically of what it looks like. So what does it look like? Well, if I look at the omega j minus 1 and the omega jth piece, then the operator q has degree 1, so that takes me in this direction. Its adjoint q dagger has degree minus 1, so it takes me in this direction. And we continue on. And the Hamiltonian, that has degree 0, so it's going to transform these pieces to themselves. In particular, you notice now if I were to forget about half the data, if I were to forget about Q dagger, I would be in the situation of having a co-chain complex. And likewise, if I forget about Q, I would be in the situation of having a chain complex. And that will be important in subsequent lectures. Let me also mention very quickly the other Z2 part 2 here. So the other piece of the outer automorphisms. So if this is a symmetry of the theory, if it's actually realized, what does this mean? Well, in this case, there should be a unitary operator, C, which acts in the following way by reversing the degree here. And in particular, it should generate the action on the superchargers. Oh, I'm sorry, it's minus j again. Okay. Like this. And so in particular, the consequences of this are is that my Hilbert space should actually be promoted. I should end up pairing up the components of, say, degree j and minus j, and these should all pair up into representations of O2. Okay, so this charge conjugation is not going to play too much of an important role in what I want to say. The most important one will be the fermion number. Okay, so let me give you some examples of supersymmetric quantum mechanics now. And the examples that I give are going to be modeled on the sigma model that I described earlier. And a slightly different version of that. Okay, so my first example I'm going to call again, just like before, the Riemannian sigma model. And the data is exactly the same as it was before. X should be a compact, smooth Riemannian manifold. And this time for the Hilbert space, instead of taking functions on that space, we're going to look at differential forms on the space. So in particular, there's going to be a natural grading by the form degree. So I can write omega j to be differential forms of degree j. And in particular, I should tell you what the inner product on that space is. Well, it's the natural one that you would write down in Hodge theory. Which utilizes the Hodge star operator. Okay, so this is the Hilbert space. Let me describe the algebra, the supersymmetry algebra, and how they're realized geometrically. So the supercharges, Q and Q dagger, are going to be given by the Durham operator, D, the exterior derivative. And Q dagger will simply be given by its adjoint with respect to the natural inner product that we have. Okay, so then we can ask ourselves what the Hamiltonian of the system is. Well, the Hamiltonian was the anticommutator of Q with Q dagger. In this case, that's the anticommutator of D with D dagger, otherwise known as the Laplacian acting on forms. So essentially, what the quantum mechanics is doing is encoding the structures that I have on a Riemannian manifold. Let me describe the fermion number operator. So I've already given this away by exactly writing, by identifying the degree here with the form degree. So the fermion number operator I could write explicitly in the following way. So in local coordinates, I would have something like this, dxi contraction with the vector field along the coordinate directions. This is the thing that exactly measures the form degree. Yes, I'm going to come to that exactly now. Yeah. So now when I come to point two, I also mentioned we had a charge conjugation symmetry. And if we want to realize that as a symmetry in the theory, then we're going to need to shift this by adding something like the dimension of the space, which is exactly what I think what you're asking. Yes? Okay, so point two was the charge conjugation. Well, if I look at the Hodge star operator, what does that do? It's going to take a J form and give me back a M minus J form, where M is given by the dimension of my target space. And so this is not exactly of the form that we wanted. The charge conjugation operator should take omega J and map it to omega minus J. And so if I want to preserve this symmetry in the quantum mechanical theory, then what I should do is I should shift my fermion number operator to be the anticommutator of dxi with the contraction along the, like this. Maybe with a half. Another way to write that is the thing that I had before. Minus the dimension of the manifold divided by 2. And so if I shift the definition of my fermion number operator in this way, then it's going to map something of degree j to degree minus j due to this shift here. And if I make this shift, then the Hodge operator realizes the Z2 charge conjugation. Okay, so this is the Riemannian sigma model. This is one example that I'm going to come back to again and again. Let me mention one thing now before I move on. So one thing to notice is that here, all of the dependence on the metric, my Riemannian metric on x, is encoded in Q dagger and the Hamiltonian. On the other hand, Q doesn't know about the metric. It's just the exterior derivative. Okay. Okay, let me now give you another model, another example. And so while the first example depended on the data of a Riemannian manifold, my second example is going to depend on the data of a Hermitian manifold. So my next example I'm going to call the Hermitian sigma model. So this time I'm going to take the target space of my sigma model X to be, as it sounds like, a Hermitian manifold. And we're going to add another piece of data E, which will allow to be a holomorphic vector bundle. Together with a Hermitian metric. So again, let me tell you how to build a supersymmetric quantum mechanics in this data. So first of all, the Hilbert space. So this time we take Dolbeau differential forms. Sorry. We take zero J forms with respect to the complex structure on the space X that are valued in sections of my holomorphic vector bundle. And again, we put a natural inner product on this space, which is defined in exactly the same way. Except here, I should perhaps mention that implicitly in writing this formula, I'm using the fact that I've got a Hermitian metric on my bundle to contract up the sections. I couldn't think of a good way to denote that, so I'll just leave it implicit in the formula. Yeah, I think I'm going to want it to be compact. Yes. Perhaps we can talk about how to deal with non-compact ones later. Okay, so what are the superchargers? Well, you might have guessed already, in this case, we're going to take Q to be the Dolbeau operator from my holomorphic vector bundle. So this utilizes the complex structure, basically is the complex structure of my holomorphic vector bundle. And we take Q dagger to be the adjoint of that, again, with respect to the inner product that I've written down. And what this means is that the Hamiltonian is given by the Dolbeau Laplacian. So instead of Riemannian geometry, this model utilizes Dolbeau. Okay, let me talk about fermion number. So the fermion number here, it's already implicit in what I've written, but the fermion number is going to be basically the form degree again. So in this notation, I might write something like, in local coordinates, I might write the operator like this. And as far as I can tell, this model doesn't have a Z2. Charge conjugation symmetry. But let me make an important note, which is analogous to the note that I made in the Riemannian sigma model, which is again that at least in the way that I've written this model, there's a difference between Q and Q dagger. In particular, Q depends only on the complex structure on my target space X and on the bundle, E. On the other hand, Q dagger and the Hamiltonian utilize the metric structures that I have, the Hermitian metric on X and the Hermitian metric on E. Okay, so in particular, Q is independent of the Hermitian metrics on X and E. So at least in the way that I've written it, in both of these models, Q plays somehow a distinguished role. Okay. Good. So these are my two examples. So in the last part of my talk, it would be great if I could have some longer pieces of chalk. There are different colors. I could write in a different color, but there's a marginally longer piece here. That will do for now. Okay. All right. So, in the last part of my talk, I want to address an important problem. So, an important question in any quantum mechanical system is, what are the spectrum of energies that the system can have? And the same is true in supersymmetric quantum mechanics. And so what I want to address is the spectrum of the Hamiltonian operator. What are the allowed outcomes of a measurement of energy of such a system? Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not taking exterior powers in the bundle here. I'm not generating it by adding like Fermi multiplets. I'm just, okay, if I were adding fermions, I would have exterior powers of the bundle. That's not what I'm doing here. Okay? Good. We could do that as well. Maybe that's a problem for later. Okay, good. Okay, so an important problem is the spectrum of the Hamiltonian. What are the allowed set of energies? And so, well, the energies have to be real, but in a supersymmetric quantum mechanics, they have to be real and non-negative. So in particular, this is an important, a crucial result, that the spectrum of the Hamiltonian should be non-negative. Let me just give you the argument for that. This is a very simple but important argument. So imagine that I have an eigenvector of the Hamiltonian with energy E. Well, I can do two things to that. On the one hand, I can contract it with the wave function. And using the fact that it's an eigenfunction, I would write that as E times the norm squared. On the other hand, I can evaluate this thing in a different way using the supersymmetry algebra. So if I substitute in the fact that the Hamiltonian is the anticommutator of Q with Q dagger, I'll get an expression like this. And writing this out, I get a sum of squares. Like this. And taken together, given the fact that this is actually an inner product, then this implies that the eigenvalue E should be greater than or equal to zero. Okay, so the spectrum should be non-negative, but the states that saturate this bound play a particularly important role, and they're what we call the ground states of the system. Ground state means state of minimum energy, and in this case, minimum means zero. So definition, the Suzy ground states saturate this bound. And so I'm going to introduce a notation for the Suzy ground states, which is curly H. So by what I wrote above, this is the kernel of the Hamiltonian. And actually, if I look at the argument that I gave for the fact that the spectrum was non-negative and ask, well, how could the energy possibly be zero? Well, the only way for it to be zero is if both of these two contributions here vanish, which also requires that the wave function is annihilated by both Q and its adjoint Q dagger. So an equivalent way of writing this is the intersection of kernel of Q with the kernel of Q dagger. This is why we call them supersymmetric ground states, because they're annihilated by both of the superchargers. Yeah.
Your proof that the energy was greater than or equal to zero involved supersymmetry.
Yes.
But like even for a non-supersymmetric system, things aren't supposed to have negative energy.
Right. So the statement that we usually require for a normal physical thing was that the energy should be bounded below. Okay. And then I can always add a constant if I want to move that up and down. But the crucial thing is that it should be bounded below. In a supersymmetric system, we actually require something. In some sense, we're fixing that constant, and we're demanding that actually it should be greater than or equal to zero. OK? Does that answer your question?
Sure.
OK. Yes. If I didn't make that clear, I should have done yes. We put that as a requirement by hand, that the spectrum should be bounded below. Yes. Yeah. No, it could be that this thing is empty. In that case, we would say that the system breaks supersymmetry. Okay. Okay. Now, I want to mention now another slightly physics-y thing, which I'm not going to make rigorous, which is an assumption that we typically make in physics, which is that the spectrum of the Hamiltonian should be gapped. So we typically assume that the spectrum is gapped. What do I mean by that? Well, I mean that there should be a gap between those states that have zero energy and saturate the bound, and then the next set of states. So a gapped spectrum might look something like this. Here are the states with zero energy, and then perhaps I have some continuum, or not, of other states. But the important thing here is that there should be a gap. In fact, all of our models that I described are going to have that property. And they're going to have a further property that they have a discrete spectrum. So in particular, the spectrum of the Hamiltonian looks something like the following. There are the ground states with energy zero, and then there's another energy level, and then there's another energy level, and so on and so forth. Right. So I think the reason I want it to be gapped is that in a second, I'm going to claim that there's an orthogonal decomposition of the Hilbert space. And I think that thing depends on this, on there being a gap here. I don't believe so, although, I mean, that's a question of analysis, and I'm certainly not going to try to say that for definite. So under this assumption that the spectrum is gapped, what we expect, I say expect because I'm not going to try to prove it in any way, we expect that there is an orthogonal decomposition of the following form. So the full Hilbert space of my theory can be written as a direct sum of the supersymmetric ground states of zero energy plus states in the image of Q plus states in the image of Q dagger. So the way you argue for this comes in two steps. One of them is very hard, and I'm not going to try to show it. Another one is easy. Okay, so step one is the hard part. The hard part is to show that there's an orthogonal decomposition into the kernel of H plus the image of H. That's the thing that I would expect to depend on this assumption that I'm making. The easy part is the remaining. So the bit that I'm left with here is the image of H, the kernel of H, is what I'm calling curly H, my Suzy ground states. What I'm left with is the image of H. So suppose I have an element of the image of H. Then I can write that as H acting on something else. But now I can just use my Suzy algebra like this. And I would write that as Q of Q dagger acting on omega plus Q dagger of Q acting on omega. And this here is in the image of Q. And this guy is in the image of Q dagger. So this shows that there's a canonical decomposition of the image of H into the image of Q and the image of Q dagger. And it's easy to check that these two things are orthonormal. OK. If you don't like my gapped assumption, then maybe I should just assume this. OK, so let me give you, let me show you how that works out in the two models that we have. You might you might recognize the kind of arguments that I've been making from Hodge theory. That's exactly what they are, just written in an abstract notation. So let me explain how this works out in the two models. So the first one is my Riemannian model. Well, in this case, the supersymmetric ground states are given by the kernel of the Hamiltonian. In this case, that's the kernel of the Laplacian acting on forms. Otherwise known as harmonic forms. And in this case, my orthogonal decomposition is exactly the Hodge decomposition into harmonic forms plus the image of D plus the image of D dagger. Again, my second example in the Hermitian sigma model is very similar. In this case, my supersymmetric ground states are given by harmonic forms. But now for my Dolbeau operator. And again, in this case, the orthogonal decomposition that I have is of exactly the same Hodge type, Hodge decomposition. Okay, so that's pretty much all I have to say today. So let me just finish by giving an advertisement for what I want to say in the next lecture. Okay, so the first thing I want to remind you is two things that I mentioned about the two examples that I had, was that the operator Q, the supercharge Q, was tended to be independent, at least in the way that I wrote it, independent of metric structures. So in particular, in the Riemannian sigma model, it was independent of the Riemannian metric. And in the Hermitian sigma model, it was independent of the Hermitian metrics on the target and the bundle. And indeed, that suggests that the operator Q should be encoding some kind of, in the first case, say, topological information about the target. And so that's what I'm going to look at next time. So in particular, I'm going to look at homological structures in supersymmetric quantum mechanics that are associated to the supercharge Q. OK, so supersymmetric quantum mechanics is certainly more than just focusing on a single supercharge. We also have a Hilbert space structure. We have the adjoint of Q. But in the remaining lectures, I'm essentially going to focus on just Q itself and the homological structures that arise from that. OK, that's all I have to say. The question was, if I understand it, in my Hodge decomposition, I guess in particular in this model here, I was using ellipticity. And the question, I think, is how that perhaps realizes itself in the physical construction and whether it's to do with Lorentzian versus Euclidean. I think the issue of Lorentzian versus Euclidean, I think, should not be related to that. In particular, you know, here I'm focusing on things, the Susie ground states that are annihilated by H in particular. So they're not evolving in time. So the particular issues that come in from Lorentzian versus Euclidean, I don't think play a role in that statement, but certainly there's some underlying assumptions that you mentioned about to do with this. Yes. Yes. Yes, that's another reason why I don't think it's related. That's exactly why I don't think it's related to Euclidean versus Lorentzian.
In other words, it is related to the fact that you used a Riemannian metric and not a pseudo-Riemannian.
Oh, yeah, yes, yeah.
Versus
that's a whole
Lorentzian
different issue. Absolutely. This is not to do with the signature on the target at all. I think that, for me, it's very important that it's Riemannian on the target, yes, or in this case, Hermitian.
questions, but we can try this. Apparently, these are meant to be.
So in your second example of like a quantum mechanical operator algebra, you took a Riemannian manifold and created a operator algebra from that and said that intuitively this is supposed to be a quantization of the space of maps from time into the manifold.
Yeah.
So then later you had this example labeled, you know, these examples labeled Riemannian sigma model and Hermitian sigma model.
Yeah.
And so, you know, what are these? Are these also supposed to be quantizations of something like a space of maps?
So certainly in the first case, in the Riemannian case, the statement is the same as in the non-supersymmetric case, that I could build a path integral or Lagrangian construction of this supersymmetric quantum mechanics as something involving maps into the Riemannian target space. And that's also true in the Hermitian sigma model in a certain sense. Although to talk about it as maps into a target, I think I would need to say something a bit more sophisticated.
Okay. So in particular, the Riemannian sigma model example, this is actually sort of the same as the earlier example you gave with the Riemannian manifold. So you're making the statement that the sigma model of maps from time into a Riemannian manifold just always has the supersymmetry hidden in it, automatically supersymmetric.
No, because in the first, I took the Hilbert spaces to be different. In the first case, I took the Hilbert space just to be functions on the target.
Right.
And in the second case, I took it to be forms on the target.
Right. So they can't be the same.
If you just hand me the data of a compact, smooth Riemannian manifold, then I can, if I want, construct a supersymmetric quantum mechanics. Or I could forget about some of that structure and just regard it as a non-supersymmetric model. Okay, I can do either of the two.
So these are both quantizations of the same classical theory and?
No, the classical action would be different in the two cases. One would have lots more fields than the other.
Ah, okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Yeah. Are there any other really quick questions? I don't know. I wanted to just sort of see if I could make the connection between your talk and Phil's, and maybe you can confirm or deny whether I did it correctly.
Okay.
So from your talk, if you took classical limit, you were talking about the algebra of operators being differential operators, and the classical limit of that would be functions on T star of your Riemannian manifold. Mm-hmm. And Phil would tell me, hey, the interesting thing to look at there is a Poisson bracket,
right,
which would be the usual Poisson bracket, and then maybe his homological vector field would be trivial. Is that right? I'm just thinking about T star as a normal manifold with none of this superstructure.
So, I mean, maybe I can just say one thing that maybe going forward that this is perhaps a defect of what I'm doing, but for me, all of the homological structures will not arise from any kind of BV thing. I'm going to throw that away. I think perhaps for me, all of the homological structures will come purely from the supersymmetry. Okay. But yes, I mean, in principle, I think if you should be able to, in the examples I gave, they can be understood as quantizations of a classical system. And I would expect that to coincide with.
Could you write down the Lagrangian or the Rom complex?
Sure. But maybe I can do that this afternoon.
Sure.
Okay? Yeah.